From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the real mafia. We'll talk with former New York Times reporter Selwyn Rabb. He's the author of Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's now out in paperback. Also, we remember Nicholas Prophet. The former war correspondent for Newsweek magazine died last week at age 63. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from Ornette Coleman, and film critic David Edelstein reviews Casino Royale, the new James Bond film starring Daniel Craig. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Few people in America know more about the mafia than my guest, investigative reporter Selwyn Rabb, who spent 25 years covering the mob for the New York Times. He wrote a detailed and colorful history of the Cosa Nostra called Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's now out in paperback. Rabb's book illuminates the mob's influence in dozens of areas, from its control of New York's Fulton Fish Market, to its decision to market heroin in American cities, to its racketeering in the construction and waste hauling industries, which drove up costs for millions of consumers and businesses. Besides his reporting for the New York Times, Selwyn Rabb worked as a television producer in the 1970s. As a reporter, he exposed critical new evidence in the Hurricane Carter case. He's the author of two other books, Justice in the Backroom and Mob Lawyer. I spoke to Selwyn Rabb when Five Families was first published. Well, Selwyn Rabb, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
You know, most of us have seen the Godfather films, and there's that memorable scene in Godfather 1 where the heads of all of the crime families sit around a big oak table with their cigars and make decisions as if they were, you know, the president's cabinet deciding how organized crime in America is going to be run. I think most of us look at that and think that's just a little exaggerated. How close did the mafia have to having a ruling body, a commission?
No question they did have a commission, which was started by their organizational genius, Lucky Luciano, in 1932, in which the point was that they needed some kind of regulatory oversight over territorial disputes and about other policy questions. Eventually, with the diminution of many of the families in other cities, it became essentially a New York-based commission, with other cities and families from other cities coming to them to run things through, including who was to be the boss of the other cities, except for one place, and that was Chicago. Chicago made its own decisions. But outside of Chicago, whether it was Philadelphia or Boston or Milwaukee or St. Louis or Detroit or Cleveland, they came to New York, to the five big bosses, to make sure that the five bosses in New York, by majority vote, approved of any decision like who was going to run the enterprises in those other cities. So it wasn't a wise decision. It wasn't a smart decision to defy New York.
Now, you wrote that Lucky Luciano's rules for organization kept the Cosa Nostra functioning well for 50 years. What were these rules?
Well, the rules essentially were an adaptation of what had been established in Sicily. The most important rule was omerta, which is both the code of silence and loyalty and manhood. That's the word they like to use, and honor. So the point was you never cooperated, and anything that took place in a family within a gang or a bogata was secret and could not be discussed with anybody else. So the major point was, one, silence, and two, absolute loyalty to the regime or to the boss, that you never questioned a decision. The other major thing that Luciano created, which was really an American adaptation and an American invention, was he created a chain of command on the idea that the family unit or the borgata would always exist regardless of what happened. If a boss died, was assassinated, was arrested, there was a structure. People could fill those jobs below the boss and the boss at the top. If the boss was eliminated, the way there were in other ethnic gangs, the Jewish gangs, the Irish gangs, which all existed, but had no table or structure of command, if you took out the top leadership of one of the other ethnic groups, they just disintegrated. They were loosely knit. But the mafia organization continued to exist. They were replacement parts. And that's why they have outlasted every other organized crime faction that has ever existed in the U.S.
As a measure of the penetration of the mafia in the early 20th century, you mentioned that they moved in on the kosher chicken industry. Why did they go there?
Well, it was an example of what happened in the 30s, essentially in New York. It was a very profitable industry, the kosher industry in New York City or the New York metropolitan area. And it was essentially the Lucchese family saw this as a terrific opportunity. They had been shakedowned by Jewish gangsters of the whole industry, the slaughterers, the people who raise chickens, and the sales of it. What they did was they saw it was a million-dollar industry. Prohibition was over. The mafia was looking for other ventures, and this looked perfect. They had the muscle. They moved in, kicked out the Jews, and ran it. As simple as that. Maybe they didn't eat kosher chicken, but they certainly profited from it.
There's also been this idea that the Cosa Nostra did not want its members to get involved in the drug trade, at least not directly. What does history tell us about the accuracy of that notion?
Well, it's a mixed industry. It's a mixed story. What happened was the mafia actually was pretty big in narcotics since its origin in the 20s and the 30s. But for the most part, as late as the late 30s, the Jewish gangsters or Jewish mobs that were still functioning were prominent or preeminent in narcotics. It was an important part of the mafia, but not an essential or not the most vital aspect of their business. Things changed after World War II. And what happened after World War II, there was some legislation passed in the 50s, which for the first time made narcotics a very heavy crime if you were for penalties. If you were convicted, you might get 20 or 30 years. And the bosses got together and said, this could be a problem. The problem is, for the most part, what the mafia was doing did not lead to lengthy prison sentences. So there was no compulsion, perhaps, for people to become rats, to talk, and to turn in higher people. The mafia was a little worried, especially Joe Bonanno, who ran one of the most powerful families in New York, the Bonanno family. Bonanno came up with an idea in the mid-50s that the best thing to do was to, in effect, create franchises, get the mafia out of the actual daily sale and the routine of doing business on the streets, or the retail business. So what he decided to do was he went to Italy, met with the Italian mafia in Sicily. There was a famous meeting in 1956 in Palermo where Bonanno made this offer. He said, we'll help the Sicilian mafia, which was beginning to thrive on narcotics and getting plans from the Middle East and from Turkey. And we'll help you bring in heroin. You bring it in. The American authorities have no real line on what you're doing. You're unrecognizable to them. You come in, we'll tell you where to set up shops and how to handle the street trafficking. You bring in the big supplies, you take care of the wholesaling, and what we'll do is we'll help you out, especially in the inner cities. And what organized crime, what the mafia got, was a kickback. They got a percentage. But they did not have to do any of the dangerous, dirty work.
You know, another part of mafia lore is that the mob controlled politicians and judges. How accurate is that? I mean, could they have a hand in deciding who the mayor was? Could they get help from the top, from the highest levels of City Hall?
No doubt that the mafia controlled many big city governments, New York, Philadelphia. They had a hand there, Boston, Chicago. No question. One of the ways they were able to do it is they had money, and they had volunteers, workers. They could get the vote out, and they could provide you with election campaign funds. The best example of that was New York, where Frank Costello, was really Mr. Tammany Hall, the major Democratic political organization in New York for 20 years, and made no bones about it. Costello would have big fundraising affairs, sometimes for charitable groups, sometimes for the Democratic organization. Judges would appear. Legislators would come. Nobody was in the least embarrassed. Now, for the most part, this continued into the 70s. You still had many big cities where there were these affiliations, almost open affiliations. When things began getting hot in the 70s and in the 80s, it was done more discreetly.
Our guest is investigative reporter Selwyn Rabb. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is investigative reporter Selwyn Rabb. His history of the American mafia called Five Families is out in paperback. One reason that I guess the mafia could operate with such, you know, wanton abandon in places like New York was that the FBI just was leaving him alone. I mean, for decades, J. Edgar Hoover not only didn't investigate the mafia, he essentially denied its existence. Why do you think J. Edgar Hoover was so opposed to investigating the mafia?
Hoover was very savvy about the mafia, and he didn't want any part of it. The reasons are very simple. One, he did not have the ability with the kind of agents that the FBI recruited into the 70s, almost into the 80s. They were usually people from small towns who had no identification, no knowledge whatsoever about how the American mafia operated, and they were incapable of infiltrating them. Hoover was also very worried. He knew the only way you could undermine the mafia was actually by doing undercover infiltration, and that was dangerous in two degrees. One, that your own people might be corrupted, and two, that they might have to commit crimes. It wasn't worth it for him. Hoover wanted easy opportunities. He went after the bank robbers in the 30s that got him plenty of headlines. In the 40s, during World War II, it was after spies. It was after German or Japanese agents. And then later he got obsessed with communism and leftist movements in America. And those were easy things to do. And secondly, the American Communist Party was not going to corrupt you, not going to pay you off. So he left the mafia alone.
Well, Selwyn Rabb, once Hoover was gone and the FBI did begin to investigate the mafia, they found it was very hard to make cases stick, very hard to get long penalties, which would put big guys in jail. And as you tell the story, perhaps the greatest hero of law enforcement is essentially a lawyer and eventually a law professor named Robert Blakey. What did he contribute to the fight against the mob?
Without Robert Blakey's intervention, we'd probably still have the most powerful mafia in the world operating in most of our big cities. Blakey almost single-handedly created the law that has led to the evisceration and the first crackdown on the mafia. It's called RICO, Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act. And that act was passed in 1970. Now, the important part of that was that until RICO, the higher-ups, the bosses, the capos, the consiglieres, the counselors, the underbosses, were virtually immune from prosecution. If somebody in the gang or the mafia got caught, they were usually low-level people. They never ratted. Nobody higher up was ever implicated. So they went out scot-free. The big shots continued. The organization was self-sufficient and just continue to prosper. Under RICO, if you were any way involved with that enterprise, you were equally guilty, whether or not you committed the crime. This, for the first time, gave the government, or at least the FBI, a shot at getting the big operators. What happened, however, was this law was passed in 1970, and neither the federal prosecutors nor the FBI wanted anything to do with it. They said it was a harebrained scheme invented by some law professor who had no idea about what was really going on. Blakey proselytized for a decade. He went around like an itinerant preacher, going to U.S. attorneys' offices throughout the country, lecturing FBI agents. Nobody wanted to take advantage of this new law. RICO was something new. No one dared to use it for 10 years.
So what changed? When did prosecutors take advantage of this tool?
The big breakthrough in RICO came in 1980. What happened was there was a new head of the FBI office in New York by the name of Neil Welsh, who was an iconoclast. Hoover had hated him, but Hoover was dead. Now Welsh was in a driver's seat in New York. And Neil Welsh was also a lawyer and read law journals. And he knew about RICO. And he sent two of his agents up to Cornell University, where in the summers in the 80s, Blakey was lecturing. He was lecturing about RICO. And they were impressed. They sat through these hearings, these lectures, and they said, this is a perfect weapon. Nobody's used it. They came back to New York and said, we've got this terrific weapon that nobody wants to use. At the same time, Rudy Giuliani became the U.S. attorney for what's called the Southern District, which is Manhattan of New York. He knew about RICO. He was interested in RICO. He knew about Blakey. They had their own sit-downs. And they decided a perfect case would be a case against the commission in New York, the heads of the five families that ran New York and, for the most part, ran the country. Call it the commission case. Giuliani didn't personally prosecute it. It was prosecuted by Michael Chertoff, who's now in charge of Homeland Security. And that case became a milestone. They didn't convict the five bosses, but they convicted major people, including several bosses, in this celebrated commission case in 1986. And that was the breakthrough. It showed prosecutors throughout the country what you could do with RICO.
It was clear that an informer from the mob, somebody who talked to the government, risked execution. But there were plenty of situations where someone would cooperate with the government and prepare to rat on his mafia brethren, but the families were still around. Now, was there any rule about whether you could kill or threaten family members, wives, children, parents of a mob member cooperating with government?
Civilians were technically immune or technically safeguarded. You weren't supposed to touch anyone who wasn't involved in mafia matters. However, that's broken down. It started essentially in the 80s with this whole new generation of younger mobsters came in. They started going after family members, threatening anybody who had turned or had become a government witness, that maybe they couldn't reach you, but they would go after your family. And there have been many cases of that. And the most recent was only a year ago in the Bonanno family. Tapes were picked up by the FBI, overhearing mobsters saying, well, if someone's going to rat on me and I have to go away for 20 years or 30 years, why should that rat and his family, why should his kids survive when my kids will be in trouble? So all those rules are broken down. It's no longer a gentleman's game. That's one of the theories that they'll now use to try to prevent snitches, turncoats, rats that will get your personal relatives. There are no longer civilians. Everyone is now endangered if you rat.
And what happened in that case? Did the family members get harmed?
Well, the people who made the threats were arrested, and the family members were put into the witness protection program. So that's part of the witness protection program. Another element that Blakey dreamed up in the RICO law, another great positive step, the RICO law for the first time created a witness protection program, which meant that after you testified, after you served whatever sentence you served, you and your entire family would be given new identities, the government would take care of you, and that was a great encouragement to become a government witness.
The government's gotten some huge mafia players, you know, underbosses, bosses, capos, but, you know, the kind of the base level is a couple of hundred soldiers, which each of the family has, and they're the ones who are going out committing extortion, running bookmaking, running prostitution, running narcotics, and making money. If they take the bosses away, aren't the guys still out there on the street, you know, committing crimes and raising prices and, you know, corrupting unions?
The mafia in America is never going to be eliminated for two reasons. One is called gambling, and second is called loan sharking. They're symbiotic. They work together. It's the bread and butter. It's always been the bread and butter for the mafia. And that is continuing to go on. And as long as you have that, they have the seed money to do other things. They'll go into labor racketeering, Wall Street, all the new high-tech frauds, wide open to them. They don't have to have the knowledge of how to function or create these rackets. What they do is they pick up on it. Often, a fine example of how the mob moved into Wall Street was that many brokers on Wall Street got into financial problems. They couldn't go to banks for loans. They went to loan sharks. Once they got into loan sharks, the mob guys wanted not only their money to repay the loans, they wanted a piece of their action, whatever frauds they were committing in the brokerage industries. And that's the way they functioned for 70 years, and there's still plenty of wise guys who are ready, willing, and able to handle mafia business in America.
Selwyn Rabb's book is Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's now out in paperback. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston by James Hornfisher, author of The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And from BMW, BMW, with dynamic stability control and all-wheel drive, each BMW is designed for safety. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we look back at the life and career of Nicholas Prophet, the novelist and war correspondent who covered Vietnam for Newsweek magazine. He died last week. Also, Daniel Craig takes over as James Bond in the new film Casino Royale. David Edelstein has a review. And we'll hear the new CD from saxophonist Ornette Coleman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says when Fort Worth's Ornette Coleman came along in the 1950s, his detractors said his rough and wayward jazz was too crazy to stand the test of time. 50 years later, Coleman's still standing.
When Ornette Coleman first stepped out on record in 1958, his tone was as raw as a bumpkin's feet in new shoes. But gradually, so slowly folks barely noticed, his tone got more urbane, sleeker, more seasoned, and conventionally beautiful. The reason few noticed is that the lines he plays have barely changed. The open vowels of Texas field hollers and country blues still sing through after his 48 years as a New Yorker. His sound is wonderfully voice-like, full of schoolyard shouts, laughter, sobs, prayers, joy and pain mixed together like real life. But his solos are most always orderly. He'll introduce a scrap of melody and turn it this way and that before picking up another. He keeps things moving and takes his sweet time. Ornette's live album, Sound Grammar, is his first in 9 years, though he's been gigging with a new quartet for the last three. He's always had an ear for great bass players. This band has two of them who divvy up the chores to avoid collisions. One plucks, the other bows that big violin. Greg Cohen's the picker, and after umpteen tours playing fake Ornette with John Zorn's Masada, this is a cakewalk. Classical whiz Tony Falanga's bass sings, echoes Ornette's alto, or scrapes out extra rhythm, recalling his great predecessor, David Isenson. Throw in a drummer taught by the boss from scratch, son DiNardo Coleman, they're good to go. Coleman needs musicians attentive to, but unfazed by, his little detours or shortcuts through a tune. This rhythm section holds him up without hemming him in, as when he bobbles a quote from Beautiful Dreamer and goes back to get it right. Quote, that deliberate deserves a footnote. Beautiful Dreamer, Stephen Foster, 1862, a late career tune with a built-in sob. I hadn't made that Foster connection before Coleman made it for us, but it makes sense. By now, Ornette does belong on the list of our great sentimental melodists. He's that big. Skies of America size.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Sound Grammar, the first live recording from Ornette Coleman in 9 years. Coming up, we remember novelist and war correspondent Nicholas Prophet. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Prophet, the novelist and veteran war correspondent, died last week of kidney cancer at the age of 63. Prophet's first novel, Gardens of Stone, was drawn from his experience in the Army as an honor guard at Arlington National Cemetery. Though Prophet served in Arlington before casualties began coming back from Vietnam, his book tells the story of a sergeant who's frustrated by burying dead soldiers rather than serving in Southeast Asia. It was made into a film by Francis Ford Coppola. After his military service, Prophet went to college and then covered the Vietnam War and the Civil War in Lebanon for Newsweek. He wrote two other novels, Embassy House and East of Eden. Terry spoke to Nicholas Prophet in 1987.
My father was a career Army sergeant, and I went into the Army and spent 3 years in it before I went to college. And I ended up a sergeant, buck sergeant, a low one. But so I've had this fascination with and association with the Army all of my life, and I thought that that was a side of things that hadn't been told before. I especially wanted to look at the institution of the Army and get across the idea of the Army as a family and take a look at what the war did to the institution of the Army.
When you found out that Coppola wanted to buy the rights to your book, were you able to find out what it was that attracted him to your book?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really talked with him about it. I think ritual, the rituals. It's a book full of rituals, and Coppola's previous work has always had a strong emphasis on rituals. The Godfather movies, for instance, male bonding between my protagonists, that sort of thing has also interested him. He's a very family-oriented director. He's got a very strong sense of family, I know, both in his personal life and in his vision as a director. And I think the elements of family, of the Army as family, and of these people coming together as family members who aren't really related by blood, appeal to him. I'm guessing for him. I don't really know, but that's what I suspect.
Let's talk about the part of your life that your novel Gardens of Stone and the film Gardens of Stone is based on. It's loosely biographical, autobiographical.
Loosely, right.
So you in 1961 and 64 served in the Old Guard. Now, what is the Old Guard? Most of us have seen it, but I never actually identified it as the Old Guard before.
No, it's those background people you see in shots of the president when his plane lands or at a White House ceremony. They're the guys standing in the background holding flags or standing at attention. It's basically a ceremonial battalion, part of the 3rd Infantry. It's one battalion of the 3rd Infantry. It's stationed at Fort Myer, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington. And it does many, many different jobs, everything from putting together a color guard in old powdered wigs and colonial uniforms out at Mount Vernon, to guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to providing escort platoons for the president when he arrives at an airport or takes off from Washington, to greet heads of state that are coming in. But basically their job is to bury people at Arlington Cemetery to render the final military honors. There are firing party teams, and those are the guys that give the 21-gun salutes, and there are casket bearer teams, and their job is just to carry coffins. There's a caisson section which handles the horses that are used in the ceremonies, and then there are just marchers who march along as an armed escort.
Were you glad that while you were in the military, your service was in the Old Guard?
No. I mean, I thought it's a very spit and polish outfit. A haircut every other day, shaving 3 times a day, shining shoes all the time, uniforms pressed all the time. You couldn't even wear your shoes inside your barracks. You had to go in stocking feet because you might mess up the floor. You had to be ready for inspection all the time. And that kind of thing I thought was rather Mickey Mouse and didn't appeal to me greatly. I was really out of the service before the Vietnam War really got started. As I say, I got out in 64, and the buildup in Vietnam started in 65. So when I wrote the book, I had to I advanced the time a bit because I wanted to get the Vietnam thing in. I wanted to use Arlington Cemetery as a metaphor for Vietnam, as a final resting place for our casualties. And if I had been in the Old Guard doing those kinds of things during the height of the fighting, like the people in the book and in the movie are, I don't really know how I'd have felt about it. It seems kind of silly to be doing that sort of thing when people are dying 10,000 miles away.
In the movie, one of the sergeants says to one of the young men just arriving, "Welcome to show business."
Right.
Because there's so much ceremony and so much emphasis on clothing. And somebody else says that the Old Guard is the kabuki theater of American arms. Now, was there a lot of sarcastic comments like that when you arrived?
There were, because there are a bunch of, there's always sarcastic comments from young soldiers, no matter what they're doing and where they are. There was a lot of toy soldiers talk. But at the same time, I think almost every man in that unit knew that the requirements to be accepted were quite strict. You had to have a certain military bearing. You had to be a certain height. I was very surprised that I was accepted into it simply because I wear glasses. And today, that's not really a hindrance. If you wear glasses and you're assigned to that unit, they issue you contact lenses and pay for it. But at that time, I don't even think contact lenses had been invented yet. But I wore glasses, and as a result, did not get to do any of the high visibility things like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or casket bearers. I was always in an honor platoon, and more often than not, in the back rank where you couldn't see me very well.
You know, one of the things in the story of Gardens of Stone is that the soldiers who are on burial detail all the time, as you were, their attitude towards the people who they're burying changes as they start to realize that it's them. You know, it's people like them. It's people who they know. Did you go through anything like that yourself? And I wonder what it's like to preside over burials of people who are totally anonymous to you. And it's a ritual you perform day after day. It's like theater, really.
You went through the first funeral was a very moving and shattering experience and terribly poignant. In fact, I think tears came to my eyes the first funeral I pulled. There's the full panoply of ceremony and the rendering of taps and the black stallion with the boots backwards in the stirrups and the rat-tat-tat of the drum. It's very moving. By the time you've done your 100th, you tend to become a little irreverent toward the whole process. The Old Guard, we called burials drop jobs. We called the cemetery itself either the boneyard or the garden. And we were burying 12, 13, 14 people a day. I wasn't around to bury people when the war was going on, although my characters in the book are. I don't know what I would have felt if the people we were burying were our age. Most of the people that I was burying as an 18, 19-year-old in 1961 and 62 were older men. They were colonels and captains and sergeants, men who had done 20 or 30 years and had died from natural causes brought on by the kinds of illnesses that older people are prone to. I don't know what the reaction would have been if the casualties had been 19-year-olds just like myself who had been killed in a war while I was in a very cushy post stateside and these kids were over in Vietnam.
You know, you were describing Gardens of Stone as in a way being about the military as family and the ruptures in that family that were caused by the war. Your father was a career military man, and I imagine there were probably ruptures in your family when you were against the war, especially when you were reporting from Vietnam.
Not really. I avoided all that
by being in Vietnam?
No, but by having my father die on me.
I'm sorry.
No, he died in 63. I remember it very clearly because I was home for his funeral when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I got called by my unit off of my father's funeral. He had been buried, but I was still helping my mother do some administrative things, and I got called away because they needed every available body to back at Arlington to participate in the state funeral for JFK. They hadn't pulled a state funeral like that for many years, so they were blowing dust off the procedure books and panicking, running around panicking. So in a way, I'm almost glad he didn't live to see it. He loved the Army very much. He was a veteran of World War II and of Korea, and I don't think he could have taken what what the Army went through in Vietnam.
When you were reporting in Vietnam, did you spend a lot of time thanking your lucky stars that you were there as a reporter and not in the military?
Yes, of course. I spent a lot of time out in the field with the troops. And part of my job is actually go looking for trouble. I probably saw as much, if not more, combat than the average GI who was over there. But I never forgot that I had that option to get out, to bug out any time I wanted to. And I exercised that option a couple of times where I thought that this was a no-survivor situation and caught that last resupply helicopter out. And I felt badly about it, but not badly enough to stay. And one time when I left, there were about 15 people left, and they were all killed. And if I had stayed, I'd have died. And I'd gotten out on the last resupply helicopter.
Did your military training come in handy as a reporter?
Not much. I did not, as a matter of principle, carry a weapon. I was a reporter, not a combatant. I had some trouble with some of the units I went out with. They didn't want to carry me along unless I armed myself, and I just refused. And usually talked them into letting me come along anyway. It helped a little bit. It certainly helped in my reporting. Yes, I knew some basics about strategy and tactics and small unit maneuvers and that sort of thing. So it did help.
What was your position on the war by the time you got there for Newsweek?
The position of my generation in general was that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't working out. I think it was fairly obvious by that time. I went to Vietnam with the idea of being an objective reporter and making my own decisions, but I think I was predisposed to thinking that the war was a colossal mistake, a misadventure for our country. When I left 2 years later, I had not changed my mind at all. I still thought it was a colossal mistake. I think that the way I got to my decision was a little different than before. For instance, I had a great deal of respect for the American fighting man and for the kids that were over there and what they had to go through. Not very much respect for the politicians and some of the higher brass involved.
Terry spoke with Nicholas Prophet in 1987. He died last week at age 63. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new James Bond. This is Fresh Air. Ian Fleming's first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, was the source of a 1954 TV adaptation and an expensive 1960s spoof that went off the rails in production when its star Peter Sellers abruptly quit. Now the producers of the familiar Bond series have acquired the film rights and mounted their own version. The film also boasts a new Bond, Daniel Craig. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
A couple of years ago, I was watching the thriller The Jacket, and one of the mental patients was overacting like crazy. But there was something otherworldly about the actor. I couldn't take my eyes off him. Then in the credits, I saw that it was Daniel Craig, and I'd seen Craig a month before as Ted Hughes in Sylvia, where he was every inch the black marauder of Sylvia Plath's letters. As the son of crime boss Paul Newman in The Road to Perdition, he was a freaky paranoiac with shocking blue eyes. He was a hunky handyman in The Mother, and a bespectacled intellectual at arm's length from his own life in Enduring Love. His physicalizations, his rhythms, they were different in each role. I couldn't wait to see what Craig would do with James Bond. In Casino Royale, he's absolutely fascinating, which is not an adjective you could apply to many Bonds. Only one, actually, Sean Connery. And what made Connery the ideal was that he could be rough, super masculine, and at the same time elegant. Craig isn't elegant, but the movie isn't about Bond the bon vivant. You could call this Bond Bond Begins. 007 has only just earned his license to kill. In the meantime, he's studlier than his four predecessors put together. He tips his head forward like a boxer, an impression reinforced by his semi-smashed nose and skin that often sports fresh lacerations. He's also pumped up, with huge cords around his neck, in a scene in which he's stripped and tortured. Although Judi Dench is back as the scolding distaff M, everything else in Casino Royale is played as if for the first time. The classic Bond tropes are there, but they're rearranged to catch you off guard, and the villain isn't the usual Blofeld-like wannabe world dominator, but a financier and gambler called Le Chiff, whom Bond is supposed to bankrupt so that the Brits can have leverage to grill him about his terrorist connections. He's played by the amazing Dane Mads Mikkelsen, made up to bring out his liver lips and monkeyian cheekbones. When he sits opposite Bond at a high-stakes poker game in Montenegro's Casino Royale, Le Chiff clicks his rectangular chips as if he's a new breed of praying mantis. He's blood-curdling. He needs to be, since Casino Royale front-loads the dazzling action set pieces and then settles into something considerably more cerebral. It's a mysterious choice, and some viewers will feel cheated when Le Chiff leaves the picture early and Bond has an extended romantic interlude in Venice. Even at its most languorous, though, the film has a pulse. The luscious Ava Green, best known for Bertolucci's The Dreamers, is a banking emissary called Vesper Lind. She's supposed to keep tabs on the vast sums of cash Bond risks against Le Chiff. In a limo on the way to the Casino Royale, the couple goes over their cover story.
It's just last-minute details. Apparently we're very much in love.
Do you usually leave it to porters to tell you this sort of thing?
Only when the romance has been necessarily brief. I'm Mr. Arlington Beach, professional gambler, and you're Miss Stephanie Broadchest, heiress.
I am not!
You're going to have to trust me on this.
Oh, no, I don't.
We've been involved for quite a while. Hence the shared suite.
But my family is strict Roman Catholic, so for appearance's sake, it'll be a two-bedroom suite.
I do hate it when religion comes between us.
Religion and a securely locked door. Am I going to have a problem with you, Bond?
No, don't worry. You're not my type.
Smart?
Single.
No, Bond likes him married. No entanglements. And Vesper's banter sometimes cuts too deeply for a superficial fling. She even engages him in an impudent game of what's my backstory. She guesses he's had the best education money can buy, but didn't come from money, and that he still carries a chip on his shoulder against the elites. In the early Bond movies, the violence was both brutal and stylish, with witty curlicues. In Casino Royale, it's mostly brutal. But that's in keeping with Craig's evolving 007. Here, he's not housebroken. He's still working out the secret agent persona. In one scene, Vesper presents Bond with a new tuxedo, and after he slips into it, he regards himself in a mirror with shining eyes. You see him realize that it's a good look. I hope Craig finds more discoveries like that in Bond, and I hope he gets to wear that tuxedo again and again.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. And from Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Kiran Desai won this year's Booker Prize for her novel The Inheritance of Loss. She's the daughter of novelist Anita Desai. On the next Fresh Air, both mother and daughter talk about their life in letters. Join us for the next Fresh Air.